This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. So sit back with your cup of coffee and your pastry and enjoy today's program, which will focus on some technical discussion in the first half and a special guest in the second half of the program. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the premier law firm of Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com or give us a call at 703-218-2100. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where there are articles, videos, and audio. Of course, the old radio shows are stored there on topics of interest in tax, business, and estate planning. Today, we're going to be talking about private equity. Private equity as a phenomenon has grown in recent years such that there are trillions of dollars employed in the economy to invest in companies through the private equity source. In a typical private equity deal, you're talking about an investment of equity, not debt, in private companies. And an investor buys a stake in a private company, usually not a public company, with the hope of ultimately realizing an increase in value of that stake over time. There's a massive and variegated industry devoted to pursuing wealth creation in the private equity markets today. The practice of many people and many different parties conducting business through a partnership is an ancient practice. Among the earliest commercial partners were ones that were formed to raise money for seafaring ventures. Remember back when Christopher Columbus explored the New World, he was staked by private equity investors. Private equity firms today are groups of individuals who come together to pursue these investments in private companies. While almost all private equity professionals invest a portion of their own money, private equity firms today primarily deploy capital for the benefit of others. These firms tend to be partnerships, limited partnerships usually, similar in form to other private professional service firms like law firms or accounting firms, for example. A private equity firm today may range in size from just two people and a secretary to hundreds of investment professionals. The business model of a private equity firm is as follows. Raise money from external sources. Invest the money in a series of private equity deals, and then sell or exit those investments, often several years later. Then return the proceeds from these exits to the external capital partners and hold back 20% of the profits for the partners of the private equity firm. This 20% take is called a carried interest. Carried interests are the gravitational pull at the center of the private equity universe. General partners also earn substantial income from other fees, such as management fees and also transaction fees. Private equity firms typically raise capital for investments into a fund, usually in the form of a limited partnership, which is a kind of a fund that gives control and a disproportionate share of the profits to the general partners, even though most of the capital comes from outsiders. The limited partners in the funds, the investors, have little control over how the fund is managed and typically agree in advance to a lopsided profit-sharing agreement as well as to other fees that are payable to the general partner. If successful, a private equity firm can create a fortune for its founders. Here's a simple example. Let's say a group of five general partners raises $500 million into a fund and invests it into a series of deals. When those investments are finally sold off, the resulting value is twice the value of the fund, of the original investment, $1 billion. This means that the fund has a profit of $500 million. As part of the profit-sharing agreement, the general partners get to keep 20% of that $500 million profit, which equals $100 million. Assuming they all share equally in this windfall, each general partner gets to keep $20 million. Nice work if you can get it. This example doesn't even factor in the other potentially lucrative management and transaction fee streams that are available to general partners. Now, it's not easy to generate a private equity fund, raise the money, and it's not easy to deploy the capital. The key skills that the general partner must have include the following. Deal sourcing. Private equity firms have to be very skilled at finding attractive investment opportunities, at figuring out what is a good investment opportunity, and generating a lot of flow of these types of deals. They also have to be adept at research and due diligence, meaning that before agreeing to do a deal, the general partner has to very painstakingly form a view on the future of a given industry or market or product, and then on the potential of a particular company in that market, it would decide whether or not to deploy the capital in the deal. They have to deeply understand the inner workings of this portfolio company that they might invest in, and based on that, determine the right price to be paid for the investment in the company. They'll build elaborate models that show what the cash flow expected to be thrown off by that company will be, and these elaborate models serve as the basis for their investment decisions. The GP, the general partner, also has to be adept in financial engineering. This is a bit of jargon that refers to a dealmaker's ability to masterfully structure an investment to his or her best advantage. A good financial engineer will be able to rework a company's balance sheet and creatively apply capital market products, most importantly corporate loans, as a way that the equity provider can be positioned to get as much as possible from the deal. General partners who have experience in the financial markets often possess advanced financial engineering skills. In addition, the private equity firm general partner has to be skilled in operating the business. Once the private equity firm makes the investment, the general partner is charged with adding value to the company or at least monitoring it so that its performance does not deteriorate and, in fact, appreciates over time. Many firms have operating partners, executives who've had experience in the particular industry of running a company in that sector. For example, a private equity firm that acquires a chemicals company will often appoint a former CEO of another chemicals company to oversee the new investment. A GP also has to be a good salesman. They have to gain the confidence of many different parties. They have to convince investors to sign up for lengthy commitments to put in money into the fund. They also have to convince management of a potential portfolio company that they will be good and valuable investment partners. They have to convince potential buyers on the public markets or in the merger and acquisition market that the portfolio companies they are building are worthy of good valuations that will allow them to exit from the fund. Private equity firms today have larger and larger rosters of professionals charged with managing voluminous non-deal aspects of the business. These professionals include chief financial officers, operating officers, investor relations folks, and communications professionals. It also includes lawyers and human resource professionals, technology experts, and capital markets specialists. So the GP is not going to be the chief cook and bottle washer. They're going to employ the skills and resources of outside third parties. The addition of these back office professionals is part of the institutionalization of the private equity industry over time. It's moved away from its original boutique, scrappy roots, where historically a small group of GPs did do everything themselves. Today, it's a sophisticated industry. Most private equity funds are designed to make a number of investments over a specific amount of time. It's called the investment period, usually anywhere from 5 to 7 years. Most funds have rules against any one deal taking too much of the resources of the private equity fund. These diversification rules may say, for example, that no one private equity investment can get more than 20% of its capital from the fund. Some funds are created to do one deal. Others are going to really be investing in many different portfolio companies. There are many kinds of private equity deals, and we'll talk about that on a future show. But suffice it to say that a private equity fund is used to make equity investments in private companies. Debt used in deal structures comes from other sources, such as banks. Here's how a private equity limited partnership might work, starting with a limited partner's decision to put money into the fund. When the limited partner, you, an investor, in a private equity fund decides to invest, no money changes hands initially. Instead, the limited partner commits a certain amount of capital that is going to be managed by the general partners. In doing so, the limited partner signs a binding commitment, which is a legal agreement, to contribute capital over a period of time. In our next show, I'm going to explore a detailed example of how a private equity fund might work. But in the meantime, if you've got questions on investing in private equity funds or how to find a private equity fund that could invest in your portfolio company, call us at Odin, Feldman & Pittleman at 703-218-2100 or visit us on the web for one of the many attorneys that can help you in this complex area of law. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth. And I'm wishing you a happy holiday season, and tune in for our special guest.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Did you know that S-Corps have a unique hybrid status capable of producing savings not available to other business entities? Income generated through an S-Corp and reported on a shareholder's return can be classified either as wages or as profit distributions based on a variety of factors. The outcome of that determination matters a lot because amounts treated as wages are subject to payroll taxes while profit distributions are not. Depending on the amount involved, the difference in taxes can be substantial. For example, on profits of $250,000, taking the full amount as salary results in combined payroll taxes of roughly $20,000, but taking it as a profit distribution results in zero payroll taxes. If you'd like to know more about the distinctions between S-Corps and other types of entities, give us a call at 703-218-2100.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Mark Pollack, who is a CFP, Certified Financial Planner, and member of the Financial Planning Association. For the past 12 years, Mark has worked as a financial planner with Ameriprise Financial in Vienna, Virginia. And prior to coming to Ameriprise, he worked at Merrill Lynch in Alexandria. He completed his studies at Gettysburg College, where he graduated Phi Beta Kappa with an honors degree in economics, so he knows what he's talking about. Mark and his wife reside in Falls Church, Virginia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me, Wayne.
So with the looming fiscal cliff, and I tend to be focusing on a lot on that topic on the first segment of the show, and a high level of uncertainty regarding future tax laws, let's discuss the importance of a concept called tax diversification. What is tax diversification? What do you mean by that?
Sure, Wayne. Well, if you think about the concept of diversification in the traditional sense, usually it's applied to investing. Quite simply, we live in a highly uncertain world. No one, not you, not I, obviously not Bernie Madoff, can consistently predict what's going to be the best performing investments. So conventional wisdom has dictated that one should diversify their investments. Quite simply, spreading your assets across multiple asset classes, regions, sectors, etc. So really, we're just borrowing that concept of diversification and now applying it to one's taxes, specifically in making your investment decisions, deciding, before I decide which mutual fund or which stock I would like to invest in, I want to decide what type of account I want to own that mutual fund or that stock in, because right. that's really going to dictate when I pay taxes on that money, how it's taxed, and how I can, what purpose I can access that money for.
So we've got different ways in which different types of income are taxed. We've got interest income, which is taxed one way. We've got dividend income, which is taxed another way. And then we've got pre-tax dollars and post-tax dollars. So we have retirement assets. They may not be taxed until we pull it out later on, right?
Exactly. And to complicate things further, all the rules could change starting January 1st.
They will change.
Yes, stay tuned.
One way or the other, they're going to change. I can't imagine them staying exactly the way they are today. You know, just as a refresher, the dividend rate, and that's what's scaring a lot of people, is going to go from 15% potentially up to 43.6%. Is that right?
That's correct for people in the highest income tax bracket.
Yikes. So do you feel that that's going to have an impact on the way people invest? In other words, are they going to get out of dividend paying stocks, particularly if they're in the highest tax bracket?
Well, on the margin, it could have an effect, especially in the short term. Really, what I've been advising clients is, let's not make a knee-jerk reaction. First of all, we don't know for certain what the changes are going to be, so we don't want to
dump all your stocks.
Exactly. And the second factor is, there's still very compelling reasons to own dividend-paying stocks, especially with low interest rates. People need income, especially retirees. And if it's a good core investment, we don't want to let a term I'll use is let the tail wag the dog. We don't want to dump a great long-term investment just because of tax reasons.
I think that's good advice. Now, I understand that you view the world as, in terms of owning assets, in three separate buckets. Can you tell us these buckets in which the assets are owned?
Yeah, sure, Wayne. What I've tried to do is simplify all this complicated ways different investments can be taxed and break it down into three categories. So I'll start with the first, and that's an account where any money that you put in pre-tax. So just to make sure everyone understands what I say when I'm saying pre-tax, you know, just to operate in round numbers, I'll say I'm earning $100,000 and I put 10% of my income away pre-tax.
Okay.
So that $10,000, it's going to be as if I'm taxed as if I'm earning $90,000.
Right. At least when you put it away.
Correct. And then once that money goes into the account, as long as it remains in the account, it's going to grow tax deferred. Again, just so everyone understands the concept of tax deferred, any interest, dividends, if I'm buying or selling stocks or mutual funds, exactly, capital gains, I'm not going to have to pay any tax on that as long as the money remains inside that account.
Right.
Now, once I ultimately do draw money out of this account, as you were just alluding to, I am going to have to pay tax on the money, and it is going to be taxed as ordinary income. So it's going to be taxed just as if I had earned the money. And this is really going to be your employer-sponsored retirement plan. So this might be a 401k. If
right.
you work at a nonprofit, it may be called a 403b.
Right.
If you work for the federal government, it may be called the Thrift Savings Plan or the TSP.
Mm-hmm.
So advantages in terms of this account are you get an immediate tax benefit in the year that you contribute to it. The investment should be able to grow and snowball a little bit quicker because it is tax deferred, so you're not having to pay tax on that money every single year. The downside is you do eventually have to pay the piper. So when
right.
you draw the money out, you are going to have to pay tax on it. It is going to be taxed as income. You also generally need to leave the money in there until retirement age. Typically, the IRS views that as 59 and a half. There are a few exceptions to that, but that's the typical age there. And also at age 70 and a half, you're going to be required to start withdrawing some of that money and paying tax on it every single year, whether you like it or not.
So that's the first bucket. It's the pre-tax bucket that grows tax-deferred until you pull it out, and then it's taxed as ordinary income at whatever rates are in effect at that point in time.
Exactly.
What's the next bucket?
So the next bucket is money that goes in after taxes. So this is money that I've gotten maybe through my paycheck that I've already paid taxes on. Each year, if that investment earns dividends or interest, I'm going to pay taxes on that, paying as I go.
Right.
And when I go to sell that investment, if I've been fortunate enough to make a profit on it, then I will have to pay capital gains when I go ahead and sell that investment. So this would be just really your plain vanilla. The investment terminology is a non-qualified account, but you know, most people would think of it as just an individual brokerage account, a
taxable
mutual fund.
Account. I've heard it called
exactly
that.
A taxable account.
And so what are the advantages of holding it in that bucket?
Well, the big advantage, at least for the time being, is the capital gains rate is only 15% on long-term capital gains for most individuals.
That's for another few weeks.
Exactly. So we'll really need to wait and see and what happens there. The other big advantage, and we don't want to overlook this, is this type of account is generally totally liquid. So there's no restrictions of when you can take the money out or anything of that nature. Obviously, the major downside to this type of account is the IRS has their hands in your pocket every step of the way. It's post-tax money going in. If you're earning money as you go, they're taxing it. And if you make a profit in the end, they're going to tax it.
Of course, there's ways to shelter the income from tax by investing it in stocks that are growing and appreciating in value and generating what we call unrealized gains over time. And then, of course, when you do sell it, you have to pay tax on it. But that's one way to shelter it. Or municipal bonds is another one, isn't it?
Yes, municipal bonds. And we've kind of I'll put that more in kind of the third bucket that I'll touch on. But you're correct in that municipal bonds are definitely going to shelter from tax.
So what's the third bucket?
So the third bucket is money that you put in after taxes, so just like in the example before. But once the money goes in there, it's really going to accumulate tax-free, meaning you're not paying tax on any interest or dividends that's accumulating. And the real kicker is when you go to ultimately withdraw the money, no capital gains tax. It's all tax-free. So this can be particularly valuable for someone who has time on their side, who has a long time for an investment to really compound and grow. Obviously, being able to realize all that growth tax-free can be a huge advantage.
Now, there's a difference between tax-free and tax-deferred. What I would refer to as tax-deferred is 401k or an IRA that's not taxed, that is taxed on withdrawal. Tax-free, on the other hand, there are some vehicles that we can use for tax-free investments, like a Roth IRA, right?
Exactly.
What are some other examples of that?
So a Roth IRA is a common example. Another example, a relatively new one, is the Roth 401k, or if you work for the federal government, a program they've just rolled out, the Roth TSP.
Uh-huh.
Works exactly the same tax-wise as the Roth IRA. One nice advantage of that is it does not have the income limitation. So a big drawback of the Roth IRA over the years has been if you make over a certain amount of income, you're not eligible to contribute, whereas with the Roth 401k and TSP, there is no income limitation. So regardless of if you're, you know, Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, you can still still put money in a Roth 401k.
And of course, one of the favorite ones of a lot of advisors that I've had on the show is the ability to shelter income using life insurance.
Yeah, life insurance works as well. That's, you know, certainly a more complex strategy. You know, for the purpose of today, I won't go super deep into that other than to really say that, again, to keep in mind, if you're going to evaluate that as a strategy, first thing you want to do is look at your need for life insurance. Again, you don't want to let the tail wag the dog. You can go out and get a life insurance policy and shelter this money from taxes. Meanwhile, you may end up paying more in the cost of insurance and fees on the life insurance policy than you're saving yourself in taxes. So It can work, certainly, if you have a need for life insurance, but that's something you want to evaluate in the bigger picture context of your comprehensive financial plan rather than just doing it solely for tax purposes.
What are the downsides of the third bucket? The third bucket being, I guess it's after tax, but it's maybe it's not always after tax, but it's a bucket that is tax-free, where the income
sure.
grows tax-free.
The downsides are really going to be specific to each type of vehicle. So, you know, we touched on the Roth IRA. The main drawback there is just going to be the income limitation in that some people just aren't going to qualify for it.
Which comes back into effect in 2013, right?
Absolutely. For a Roth 401k or Roth TSP, the main downside is you can only put a maximum starting in 2013 of $17,500 into a 401k or into your TSP if you're under age 50. If you're over 50, you can do a $5,500 catch up, so a total of $23,000. But with that limitation, you know, whether you do the money pre-tax or in this Roth 401k, the total cannot exceed $17,500. So obviously, if you're going to take money from that pre-tax and instead put it in the Roth, it's great. You're going to be saving money and it's going to help you in terms of accumulating tax-free in the future. But it means your take-home is going to be a little bit less as opposed to if you had just put that all that money away pre-tax.
Is the 401k, I mean, the 401k, most people rely on that as their primary retirement vehicle. And I'm nervous about people who do that because it may not be enough to save for retirement.
Yeah, that's a great point, Wayne. There's, you know, a couple things that come into play there. Number one is, is it enough? Is just maxing out your 401k enough? You know, what I would say is it really depends on everyone's situation. That's the importance of doing a comprehensive financial plan and seeing what your goals are and doing those projections to make sure that you're on track with savings. The other importance of not totally focusing on your 401k has to do with what we were talking about with tax diversification. For the most part, most people are making those pre-tax contributions into their 401k.
Right.
So a lot of times I'll sit down with clients who are preparing to retire a year or two from now, and they say, hey, Mark, you know, we want to get together, we want to develop a plan, and as part of that plan, we want you to help us manage our taxes in retirement. How can we lower our taxes?
Mm-hmm.
Say, okay, well, let's look at your situation. And they've got all their money saved for retirement in a pre-tax 401k. Well, at that point, there's not really a lot of planning that can be done.
Mm-hmm.
When we need to take that money out, it's going to be taxable as income. So the idea with the tax diversification is to try to get some money in these other buckets earlier on as we're accumulating assets. And that hopefully will give us the opportunity to have more control and more flexibility to manage the taxes in retirement.
We're talking with Mark Pollack, who is a certified financial planner with Ameriprise. Mark, how do people get in touch with you?
Sure, Wayne. I can be reached at 703-307-9096, or I can be reached via email at mark@ampf.com. That's Apple, Mary, Paul, Frank.
Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks so much for having me, Wayne.
And all of you, listen in next week for another special topic and special guest that hopefully will help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. I'm Wayne Zell, and thanks for listening to Blueprint for Wealth. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 a.m.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent